From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans were raised on inflation. We know it, we understand it, we expect it. But what about deflation? Prices not rising, but falling, and taking the economy down with them. Economists say it is now a real risk factor for the U.S. economy. This hour on Point, imagining deflation. We begin with the search for a new chairman at the troubled Securities and Exchange Commission. Bush appointee Harvey Pitt resigned under fire on Election Day. Now the White House must find a new SEC chief to rebuild investor confidence in American corporate accounting and markets. Bill Saporito is editor-at-large for Time magazine. I asked him what factors finally led Harvey Pitt to leave the SEC.
Well, Harvey just made one more political gaffe, and that was one too many. He had chosen William Webster to run a board that's supposed to ride herd on the accounting industry. And Webster told him, I was a director at a company called U.S. Technologies, and we fired the auditors, and U.S. Technologies had some problems. Mm-hmm. And Pitt didn't pass this along to the other four commissioners, and nor did he pass it along to the White House, and that ticked off everybody.
But as you say, that was the final straw. Harvey Pitt had already had quite a cloud floating over him.
Well, he did from the beginning because of his background. He was a lawyer in private practice whose clients included, you know, many of the accounting firms and the Wall Street firms that he was supposed to regulate. So it was sort of an apparent conflict of interest. Now, on the plus side, Pitt started his career really at the SEC and rose to become their general counsel at a fairly young age.
So now, who will replace Harvey Pitt?
Well, hands, please. We're looking. And it's going to be difficult because you need somebody who has enough teeth to really continue this reform movement, to really crack down on the excesses of the accounting industry and Wall Street. Yet, at the same time, it has to be someone who's acceptable to the industry because the industry, both accounting and the markets, have a lot of clout in Washington.
Can President Bush, a pro-business president, put a truly aggressive SEC chief in place?
It's an excellent question, and I don't know the answer. If he does not, it will certainly harm him. Remember, this is a president that right now is trying to cope with a pretty lousy economy. So if he does not, consumers will not have a lot of faith in the markets. And this is a huge issue right now.
We're seeing names begin to surface. We don't know if they're serious names or just names that the press is coming up with. Rudy Giuliani catches our eye right off the bat.
Well, Rudy catches everyone's eye. And, you know, nobody loves the headlines more than Rudy does.
Mm-hmm.
I find this a tough match because essentially he's becoming a Washington bureaucrat, and I don't see that role for him. Now, obviously he made a lot of headlines as a federal prosecutor in New York.
A lot of white-collar crime he pursued.
Yeah, some of it successfully, some not. So he was able to generate those kind of headlines, but that was, you know, before he was known. Now he's a known quantity. He may consider the SEC a step down.
He's known as tough. Is tough enough? Is that a sufficient qualification at the top of this pyramid?
Well, tough is great when you're a prosecutor, but when you're a regulator, it's a slightly different issue, I think. One of Pitt's strong points, purportedly, was that he could get the industry to sort of work with him, that they trusted him so that he could, you know, have a kind of reformist movement that wasn't all bare teeth and blood, that it was, you know, he'd bring them along. And if you put somebody in there who's just going to start screaming, you may not get the cooperation, and you will need some of it. You won't get that cooperation from the industry.
What other names are you hearing in consideration?
Well, the names that are being printed in the papers, Gary Lynch, the former SEC enforcement chief, mm-hmm. with Giuliani, Frank Zarb, retired chairman of the NASD, Michael Chertoff, assistant attorney general. I mean, it's, you know, my guess would be none of the above.
And why? These all sound like reasonable qualifications.
Well, yeah, because they match up well. But let's think about this again. Who would really want this job? All right. It doesn't pay particularly well. I mean, Pitt took an enormous pay cut to take this job.
Mm-hmm.
you will immediately be in the spotlight. People like me are going to be all over your case.
Second-guessing everything.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That'll take like 30, 40 seconds, you know. So it's going to take someone with a strong stomach and a strong backbone.
On the other hand, the country, the markets, really need a sense of strong, upright leadership at the top right now.
There's no question about it. In my opinion, the reform movement is really stalled and going backwards. And we've actually seen it in the Bush administration saying, well, maybe we don't really want to give the SEC that extra $200 million that was budgeted. I mean, this kind of stuff is not really good for building confidence among investors. And confidence is exactly what we need right now.
And the White House is now talking about taking weeks or months to find a new SEC chief. What's at stake here? Can it wait that long? What are the stakes?
You know, you can't blame the White House. I mean, they screwed up this one. You don't want to do that again. And you want to make sure that anyone you choose is absolutely bulletproof. Now, the markets have come back in the last month. It's been a pretty good month.
Mm-hmm.
If the economy cooperates, and you had a big rate cut yesterday, and it basically stops, the news stops being bad, then you've got some time. Then you won't have people generally howling like they were this summer when the Bush administration looked particularly inept as the market was really, really fading fast.
Bill, let me ask you then a question about the market. With the bit of a comeback here and the possibility of more, is it possible that the markets in the United States will permit the White House to finesse this, to put in someone who wasn't really a reformer, or is that just not on?
I don't think that's on. I don't think, you know, this is a big political issue right now, and this is a very good political White House. We just witnessed what they could do this week. So I think they're savvy to it. I don't think they're going to get an out-and-out reformer. It will have to be someone who is acceptable to industry. And remember, the Republicans are the party of business, so they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them. They just need somebody to slap that hand a little bit.
Bill Saporito, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill Saporito is editor-at-large for Time Magazine. He joined us from New York. After fresh cuts this week, the Federal Reserve cannot take interest rates too much lower, but prices could still fall. In fact, many are falling. Economists are now taking seriously the risk of deflation in the American economy. The odds are against it, they say, but the threat is real. And if deflation comes, a rocky economic outlook could get much worse for a long time. After a lifetime of inflation, can you imagine a world of deflation? Can you picture how falling prices could take the U.S. economy down with them? Do you fear deflation? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Greg Ipp, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Greg Ipp.
Good evening, Tom.
It's great to have you with us, Greg Ipp. You've written about deflation this week. Most of us have never experienced it. Give us a little primer for people raised in a world of inflation. What is deflation? What does it look like? What does it feel like to live in?
Well, as you know, Tom, inflation obviously is when you have most of your prices going up over time. And deflation is really just the opposite. It's when you have a broadly declining average level of prices. And you're right. Most of us have never seen it. The last time we actually had an annual deflation rate was 1955, and it was very small, less than 0.5%. The last time we saw really bad deflation was in the 1930s, the Great Depression. We had prices going down about 5 to 10% a year, and clearly we don't want to repeat that experience.
What was driving prices down in the Great Depression? Why?
It was a number of things, Tom, but basically the economy was collapsing, banks were collapsing, unemployment was flying up towards 25%, and you had a Federal Reserve that didn't seem to want to take responsibility for the fact that all this bad stuff was happening. They were obsessed with maintaining the dollar's value in the price of gold. So one of the reasons that perhaps we aren't going to repeat that sort of experience is that we don't have to worry so much about the gold standard.
We're way beyond that, but yet you say the risk is real and economists are taking it seriously. Describe how the dynamics of everyday life, of investing, of debt change when deflation kicks in. It's not as though it hasn't been seen. Japan's been struggling with it for the last 4 or 5 years. What does it feel like to live in a deflationary economy? How do the dynamics change?
Well, It's very interesting, Tom, because we have, as you've pointed out, grown up in an economy with our lives that are used to prices going up a certain amount every year. We have cost of living adjustments in our wages. We take on mortgages. We take on debts, assuming that we can pay back that 5 or 6% interest rate because our incomes and our wages are going to go up. When prices and wages start to go down, the whole thing kicks into reverse. But there's a big problem. Debts are fixed in value. They do not go down in value. So your income could go down 10% in a bad year, but your debt stays the same. So your ability to pay back that debt worsens. In a really bad case scenario, if this happens to enough people, they have to cut back spending on other things to pay off those debts. Perhaps ultimately they go bankrupt. As these things happen, they spend less and less, and the deflationary pressures build, and you can see how a cycle builds up.
So consumers spend less, therefore companies have fewer profits, but the prices they can charge for what they do sell are dropping, and everything goes into a downward spiral.
Right. You have the same thing happening to corporations. They take on all these debts because they want to invest in new products, new factories. And they figure, well, you know, prices will go up a certain amount every year, and my sales will go up a certain amount a year. And so between those two things, I should be able to pay back these debts in good time. If the opposite happens, if sales go down and prices go down, they're facing these enormous debts they took on based on faulty assumptions. And then the same thing happens to them that we just described happening to consumers. They have to perhaps lay off people or cut their wages, and perhaps ultimately they go bankrupt.
It really does sound like an upside-down world. And the other thing, you're right, everyone points out, it's obvious that happens is the government, the Federal Reserve, has less leverage to turn the economy around because its old trick of lowering interest rates as they approach zero, there's no more leverage in that crowbar.
Well, exactly, Tom. I mean, look at the current situation. We now have a inflation rate that's, you know, somewhere between 1.5% and 2%, depending on how you measure it. And the Fed just lowered its short-term interest rate target to 1.25%.
Lowest rate that in 40 years or so.
That's right, the lowest since 1961. That means the real cost of borrowing is actually negative, and that is a very highly stimulative situation. I think there's a good chance that over time that'll get the economy growing. But imagine if the inflation rate was actually negative, if we had, say, a deflation rate of 2%. You can't get interest rates below zero. If the Fed took rates all the way down to zero, they would still have a high real interest rate. That's why central bankers like Alan Greenspan want to do everything they can to avoid being in that situation.
And once interest rates get down to zero, banks have no incentive to loan because they make as much money on the money, on the cash sitting in their vault as they do on the cash that's out there at risk.
That's right, Tom. Years ago, John Maynard Keynes coined the term liquidity trap for this situation, where essentially nobody wants to borrow, nobody wants to lend. Inflation interest rates are zero. There's no incentive to lending the money instead of just keeping it as cash in your vaults. And so all this money piles up in the system, but it's not going out. It's not being lent. It's not being invested. It's not being spent. That's a very, very frightening situation to be in.
Greg, if this sounds like the Twilight Zone, why are people thinking and talking about it now? As you point out, people are saying the odds are against it, but yet there is a real chance, a real threat of this happening. Why are people focused on it now?
Well, first of all, Tom, we have a very low inflation rate. It's between 1.5% and 2%, and it's been low for 3 or 4 years. That's a good thing. Doesn't seem to be showing a big tendency to go up or go down. But it is the lowest inflation rate we've had since the late 1960s.
Which means it's not miles away from a tipping point.
That's right. But we have a lot of unused capacity in this economy. We have unemployment that's fairly high. We have a lot of factories that are going idle. We have, as you know, like lots, miles and miles of fiber optic capacity that aren't being used. We have very, very, very strong competition from overseas for everything from power tools to automobiles. These factors are all putting downward pressure on prices and, to some extent, wages as well. Those conditions didn't exist when we had this low inflation before. So there's a strong possibility that inflation will drop from current levels. It may not go negative, but the very fact that it's as low as it is already means that you are facing a higher risk than you did before. And so it's important that we think about these things and that people like Alan Greenspan think about them and you know, adopt policies that make sure that we don't end up there.
And as you've pointed out, prices of consumer goods as opposed to services are falling for the first time since 1960. Falling prices.
Absolutely. For example, I mean, the automobile makers back in the 1950s, they were actually getting reasonably sized price increases. It was the heyday of the automobile. Now prices are actually going down. You've heard about all those wonderful 0% auto finance deals. Well, that's really basically a big price cut. And it's great for the consumer, but it's murder on the automobile makers who are really struggling to make money.
And telecom companies, which are in trouble, you're right, are already having trouble supporting some of their debt because telecom prices, telephone service prices have fallen as well. We're talking tonight with Greg Ipp of the Wall Street Journal about deflation, the risk and potential consequences of prices heading down. Can you imagine a deflationary world? We're so trained by experience to expect inflation. Have you seen the signs of deflation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about deflation, not inflation, but its opposite, deflation, the risk and potential consequences of prices in the American economy heading down, and asking you, where does deflation sit in your hierarchy of risk concerns? Lower prices sound good. Do you see how they could create a kind of economic hell? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking with Greg Ipp. He's economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal and a regular guest on Point. We're happy to have him tonight. We're joined now by Jeff Madrick. He's a New York Times columnist and author of Why Economies Grow. Good evening and welcome, Jeff Madrick.
How are you?
Real well. Jeff, is it crazy to be talking about, to be worrying about deflation in the current U.S. economic situation?
Well, I think it has become a real possibility. I think it's unlikely. I think we should be worried about the current recession first, because that recession is the prelude or the next step or at least a couple of steps closer to possible deflation. But I think we should be preparing ourselves to think about this to some degree. There are different kinds of deflation in our history.
We've had some deflationary periods that were actually not signs of ill economic health.
Well, the great deflationary period that reflected broad productivity gains, a real industrial revolution, we use the word so loosely these days, was the late 1800s. Consumer prices probably fell by 40 or 50 or even 60% over 30 and 40 years in that period. They fell because corporations could make product after product much more efficiently. So the product of cigarettes fell remarkably. There was a Bonzac machine that enabled you to make 120,000 cigarettes in a single day with the same labor that you could make only 3,000 before that.
So if productivity is driving lower prices, that's a good thing.
That can be. That is typically a good thing. And I think your guest Greg Ipp would agree with me. That's not what's driving lower prices now, I would argue. What's driving lower prices now is a lack of demand and too much investment and as a consequence, too much capacity in the late 1990s.
Meaning
too much capacity to make things.
Industry has too much capacity to make things, so they're tempted to sell it at whatever price they can unload it.
Right.
And there we have a recipe for bad inflation. Jeff Madrick, how does the cycle work? Once deflation begins, why does it tend to continue?
Well, they're always vicious circles. Once you start, when deflation begins, people will buy even fewer products. Companies will find themselves with even more money, with even more unused capacity, empty stores and so forth. They cut prices even more. So you get into this kind of decline. And the question is, the liquidity trap, it becomes more than a liquidity trap. The liquidity trap, we may be in a liquidity trap right now. Mm-hmm. The Fed cut interest rates by 0.5%. The market went down. Now, we shouldn't make anything out of one day's market move, as we well know. Mm-hmm. But you can get into a liquidity trap at low interest rates and recessionary periods, because business won't invest even if interest rates are lower. They need some demand out there. So that's what we should be worried about. But once you get into that deflationary period, you just don't know. We don't have enough experience with it to know how people will react to different policies. Policies become much more restricted.
Greg Ipp, it happened to Japan, and they're still in it. They're no fools. How could it have happened? How did it happen? And how have they tried to get out of it? And why aren't they out of it?
Tom, the Japanese example is a very sobering one for us here in the United States, because it all began with a gigantic mania in their markets, their stock markets and their real estate markets, that peaked at the end of 1989. At first, the Bank of Japan thought this was a really bad thing, that all these rising asset prices were going to cause inflation. Mm-hmm. So they deliberately set out to burst that asset bubble. It worked a little bit too well. As stock and real estate prices collapsed over the next few years, it really began to hammer the economy in unexpected ways. It began to really hurt the creditworthiness of the banks and the corporations. It turned out they had built far too many factories, had far too much capacity, and Japan entered a 10-year period of stagnation. They have been in and out of three or four recessions in the last decade. Unemployment has gone from very, very low levels to above U.S., almost to equal to U.S. levels. And in the last few years, that combination of stagnation and excess capacity has started to force prices down. So yes, Japan has had deflation for the last three or four years. The Bank of Japan has done everything it can to try and stop that. It has taken interest rates to zero. The Japanese government has run up gigantic government deficits, spending billions and billions of dollars on construction projects, bridges to nowhere, and so on. And still the problem is with them. It's a very troubling, very sobering example.
And as you point out, we also had our mania here. We saw stock prices plunge 40-plus percent since early 2000. The economists who foresee and fear deflation in our economy, Greg, how do they imagine the sequence of events that would land us there?
They look at a couple things, Tom. First of all, we've had this enormous decline in the stock market since early 2000. Essentially, we've had a 40 to 50% decline in stock values. That has wiped out an enormous amount of wealth from a lot of people. Those people are basically going to have to spend less and save more. That's going to put downward pressure on consumption for years to come. Mm-hmm. Then there are other issues. There are, for example, the enormous excess capacity in many sectors of the economy. We've talked about telecommunications.
Auto.
It's also in making computers and making semiconductor chips. Automobiles, in spite of the very strong automobile sales right now, we have in the United States, we basically have the capacity to build 20% more cars in the world than there's demand for. So do not expect to see any pressure coming off the car makers anytime soon. And you already have the fiscal and monetary authorities. That is to say, you've had the federal government here run up a big deficit. You've got the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates to zero. There's some concern. We're still very weak. Unemployment is still high. Do we have any more bullets to fire at this thing to try and get the economy going again?
It clearly has the attention of some folks in the Fed. Greg, if you report that the new Fed governor is giving a speech later this month called Making Sure It Doesn't Happen Here. Jeff Madrick, if we're flirting, it's still unlikely, but if we're flirting with deflation, what steps can the Fed, the government, take to keep us away from that cliff?
Well, one of the disturbing, one can call it a sort of attitude norm in the country today is we think the Fed is the only tool we've got. We need fiscal stimulus right now. The president ignores this more or less, except in terms of his long-term tax cuts. The Democrats haven't been very good at putting a unified program together that they could talk to the American public about.
But you mean short-term tax cuts or more government spending? Is that what you're...
Yeah, exactly. More government spending. I think probably $100 billion. What we've got to do is head off... the possibility of deflation now. We don't only have to worry about deflation. We've got to worry about this recession lasting and lasting, the prospect of slow growth, the prospect of rising unemployment. The unemployment rate understates the problem to some degree. And in general, when you look back, Fed policy alone has often not worked. You need a balanced program of fiscal and monetary stimulus, or the reverse.
So dive in there and get going. I hear you saying we have heard some more about potential tax cuts, some more about potential increases in government spending just since Tuesday's election. Greg, Jeff Madrick, stand by. I want to get our callers in here. There are a lot of them who want to join us. Lauren is on the line. Welcome, Lauren. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I had a question posed to your guest. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if we should be heading for deflation, which seems to be a possibility, if not a major...
Just a possibility.
But if we should be heading there, what is the government's role to be? I mean, how can we prevent it from being the Great Depression? And how, you know, if we're headed for deflation, how do we get out of it?
We've heard a little bit of that from Jeff Madrick. Greg, let me put it to you. Jeff Madrick says we need stimulus. We need tax cuts. We need government spending, maybe $100 billion worth. Do you see that in the kind of time frame that will make a difference here?
Yes, I do, Tom. In fact, when people have studied the experience of Japan, one of the conclusions they come to is that the reason they're in the pickle that they are now is that they were too late to realize just how serious the situation was. If they had known that deflation was a real and present danger, they would have cut interest rates a lot more quickly, and they would have been much more aggressive with their fiscal stimulus. I think one encouraging thing for us is that our policymakers at the Federal Reserve in particular do realize that that is a risk, and they have cut rates much more quickly. They've basically brought our interest rates down further in a year and a half than the Bank of Japan's did in 5 years. So that's very encouraging. On the fiscal front, it's a little harder to say because it's with the deficit as large as it is now, there's going to be a lot of political opposition to doing more on that front. But certainly fiscal stimulus is something that's needed. We have to be aware of all the problems that are going on at the state and local level. We have a lot of state governments that are deeply into deficits now, and they're cutting spending and raising taxes to try and deal with that. That's something the federal government might want to look at trying to offset.
And deficits and debt become especially painful if deflation kicks in. Fan is calling from Toronto. Hi, Fan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for accepting the call.
Good to have you.
Basically, I have a question. How do you guys actually can link up the deflation scare with the global-wide misallocation of capital? What I'm referring to is essentially look at in the past 7 years, a lot of money flow into the United States through, you know, maybe the mortgage bond security market or through other means. And they basically create a profitless boom. Let's put it in a very straightforward way.
Profitless boom.
Yes. Mm-hmm. If you look at the S&P 500, the old number was like $50 per share earning. But much of it hasn't been taken into account, the pension fund cost, the stock option cost, and so on. So the actual profit is pretty low. And even you're talking about productivity growth in the past couple of years, and still that hasn't taken into account the deflation pressure we're talking about. So basically the cost drops significantly, but at the same time, the price drops even faster. So in other words, the money flow outside, flowing from the globe, mm-hmm. is actually contributing a boom, but there's no profit. I think the foreign investors are basically in a mood of denial. They refuse to accept the fact that the money they put in has created a little profit for them.
Yeah, we've got it. I want to put that to Jeff Madrick. Jeff, yeah. Is it possible that the enormous flow of foreign capital that comes into the United States every day masks a move toward deflation risk somehow?
Well, I'm not sure that was the issue, but maybe that is the issue he's going to raise. I want to be careful about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, a profitless boom is probably an exaggeration. On the other hand, there's no doubt that profits were falling. You know, profits hit their highs in 1997. Profits started to fall, and profitability, that is. So the late 1990s were not characterized by rising profitability by any means.
Mm-hmm.
The flow of capital into the country, just like the flow of money into a stock market, can reach irrational proportions quite easily. People can be fooled by fashion. To some degree, they were. One reason money flowed in was it was easy to ride the stock prices up.
But is there a connection between that and overcapacity? Did that flow of capital easier to expand beyond reason?
Absolutely. I mean, it led to higher stock prices. It led to lower interest rates. Therefore, it was cheaper to invest.
Mm-hmm.
It was coupled with the idea that people thought high technology was the answer to almost anything, and you know that nobody could see any end to it. So the answer is, I wouldn't call it a profitless boom, but I think the answer to this is yes. The high, and it was associated with the high dollar. The high dollar, the capital inflows, low savings in America have disguised an imbalance in this economy that could come home to roost and add serious problems to what we're already discussing.
The times were high. We're dealing with another.
The capital flows could reverse.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly leave.
We are dealing with another aspect of that hangover, I guess, right now, talking about deflation. David's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi there. This program is reminding me of a paper that was written about 3 years ago, in
mm-hmm.
fact, exactly 3 years ago, I believe by economist at the Federal Reserve in Richmond. I forget his name, but he talked about it was a very strange proposal, or it seemed to many at the time, of making the currency such that it would lose value at a controlled periods of time.
Greg Ipp has written about that. Greg, would you just – we'll come back to you, David, but let's give us the story of what that contemplation was, or that scenario play was, Greg Ipp.
Oh, sure. Well, basically, this economist was trying to tackle the problem of how can you get interest rates below zero. And he thought, well, basically, you charge people to keep money in the form of cash. So he came up with this idea that if you had any dollar bills in your pocket, they would have a magnetic strip on them. And every time you took them back to the bank, a certain amount of value would be deducted depending on how long you'd kept them out of the bank.
So your cash would be losing value minute by minute.
Yeah, so that would be one incentive to go out and spend the money. But it's a terribly impractical proposal. It's really troubling. It's really hard to see how that could take place, especially in this country where we see stuff like that as a backdoor tax increase.
It sounds like a massive social experimentation and even kind of mind war. But David, you had a question off of that.
Well, actually, that was just the question, were they familiar and what they thought about it. Greg Ipp has spoken to it. It is sort of a high-tech, the proposal was sort of a high-tech version of the old Silvio Gazelle stamp script proposal, which is kind of regarded as, you know, the very essence of monetary crankishness. But
but if you want to recreate demand in a period when people don't want to spend, having their cash lose value hour by hour would certainly make them think about spending it. David, thank you for your call. Robert's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
A couple of points here. First, to respond to your question, has deflation affected me or have I seen any effects of deflation? And yes, as a retailer, I have. From the standpoint of the commodity products that I purchase on a cyclical basis, the products that I'm purchasing now for the spring and summer are declining in price to the point where vendors are calling me with new prices almost on a daily or weekly basis saying, hey, we have a new price, hey, we have a new price.
And it's always lower.
And it's always lower. And there's incentives to pay early, of course, which there always is, but now there's more of those incentives from my manufacturers and vendors.
Let's see. What's your incentive to pay early? If the prices keep falling, why not wait and pay later?
Exactly right. That's also why I don't order now, because today they're giving me a price. Well, they did that last week also. So now why don't I wait till next week? Because the price will be lower again.
Wow. There's a report from the front. Jeff Madrick, yeah. That sounds like the very dynamic of deflation.
Yeah, it's the reverse mirror image of what happened in the 1970s. People bought a lot more than they probably would have bought otherwise because they felt next week the price would go up. And that made it very hard to control inflation in that period. And it will similarly be hard to control the opposite effect. So that's part of the worry.
Robert, I want to ask you, in Dubuque, what happens to your profit margin when prices are going down? Do you make more profit or less?
No, it very quickly goes down because these same vendors are not only selling me, but they're also selling other retailers the same products.
So everybody's price is going down. There's less room for a profit.
Precisely, because some of these commodity items I also sell to my customers early as pre-season sales, and in turn I'm quoting them prices, but those prices have to be price guaranteed, meaning if the price goes up, they're already locked into this lower price, but if the price goes down, the price continues to go down to the customers, and I have to rebate them what they do not have to pay now.
Well, there's a report right from the front. Thanks for calling, Robert. Jeff Madrick, that seems like just the very demonstration of what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, one difference between Japan and the U.S. should be clear. We like to spend. The Japanese culture is somewhat different.
They are great
they
savers.
Like to say it. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the great examples of economic rules and why you should always take them with a grain of salt is Japan is the great savings country, and they grew very slowly. They are a low-tax country, and they grew very slowly. America was the country that did not save when economists told us that was the most important thing we could do, and we grew very rapidly. But we have relatively low taxes compared to other countries, other developed countries also.
So maybe that good old consuming instinct will help us after all. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about deflation, about the risk and potential consequences of prices heading down. The Fed can't go much lower. What do we do if interest rates hit zero? And are you a deflation doubter? Have you seen falling prices in your world, or is it all up? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the opposite of inflation. We're talking about deflation, about the risk and potential consequences of prices in the U.S. economy heading down. Can you imagine a deflationary world? And what happens to your world if prices fall 25%? What happens to your job, your debt, your home's value? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined tonight by Greg Ipp. He's economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And Jeff Madrick, he's New York Times economist and author of Why Economies Grow. Jeff Madrick, look at debt with us for a minute. We've talked about it a bit, but there's not only a lot of corporate debt, there's a lot of consumer debt today. If we should get our scarf caught in this down escalator, what are the consequences of the big debt overhang?
Well, it makes it awfully hard to pay it back. So there probably have to be debt rearrangements.
What does that mean?
Well, take Argentina or Brazil or take the Asian financial crisis. I haven't thought this through entirely, but probably financial institutions will have to start forgiving some debt, restating it or lengthening it.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it much more difficult for the financial institutions to operate. And it's, you know, they start, because their financial health starts being jeopardized. So you get into some serious problems. Can I just clarify one thing about this?
Yes, please.
If deflation occurs, it will not be the only bad thing that's going on in the economy at that time.
Fill that picture out.
Right. The implication is that lots of people will not have jobs because it will be in severe recession.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we didn't have deflation, you know, if they don't have jobs, they're not going to be able to buy anything. It makes demand for these goods worse. Corporations will invest even less.
Mm-hmm.
Or certainly not invest more. What we do have, however, we do have, you know, a couple of modern devices that help that. We do have something called automatic stabilizers.
Such as?
Unemployment insurance
mm-hmm.
goes up when people get money.
So they're not immediately destitute. They've still got some
right.
cash.
And there's some buying power in the
mm-hmm.
economy.
Mm-hmm.
People will still have their Social Security. Welfare benefits to some degree will still be
mm-hmm.
being paid out.
Mm-hmm.
So there are benefits. There are these automatic stabilizers that keep us from this is why it's unlikely we will have a depression again, but if not impossible or
mm-hmm.
deflation.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things that's happened to those automatic stabilizers, however, is they've been cut back. Unemployment insurance was cut back significantly in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Even Social Security benefits have been cut back.
So people
Welfare
won't be,
obviously has been cut
And people
back.
Won't be spending off of those bases like they might have been
right.
earlier.
Right. So we have additional reasons to think about fiscal stimulus. As Greg said, the state and local governments can't borrow. So they have to cut back spending if they're not getting the tax revenues they need. They need money now.
Mm.
Unemployment insurance is going to run out for 2 million people in December. Those unemployment insurance benefits have to be extended. It's no fault of their own, for most of them anyway,
mm-hmm.
that they can't find jobs in this economy.
Yeah, just try finding one right now. Greg, if you also point out, you're quoting people saying it requires a pretty ugly scenario to bring this deflation to be.
Yeah, I think it's important, first of all, Tom, to point out that a lot of the examples that we've discussed regarding prices going down are from the goods sector.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, we spend over two-thirds of our money on services.
And what's
and
the picture there?
And prices are still going up.
Hmm.
I mean, if you've had to pay a health care bill lately, if any of your listeners are going to college, they know what's happening to tuition
yeah.
prices. And certainly the price of a house hasn't gone down very much recently, although watch this space.
Mm-hmm.
So let's keep things in perspective. The overall level of prices is still going up. And services tend to be a lot less cyclical than goods. You can't really have an overcapacity of haircuts, for example, so you don't tend to get a lot of price competition there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of competition from China for things like, you know, power tools and hardware and so on, but there's no competition for nursing services or bricklayers. So I think that we have to keep that thing in context.
And in fairness, you quote Milton Friedman saying he remains more concerned about inflation than deflation, even now.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that we still have a heck of a lot of tools in our war chest to fight this thing off. I have a strong confidence that interest rates at today's level are going to do the job given enough time. And also remember, As we said out at the outset, prices can go down for good reasons. Mm-hmm. We've got a tremendous productivity performance in this country right now. In fact, the Labor Department said today that productivity was up over 5% in the last 12 months, which is like the highest rate of increase in almost 30 years. And basically what that means is that companies can make more stuff, charge less for it, and still pay pretty good wages. Mm-hmm. And in fact, wages are going up by about 3% a year.
And 4% up on productivity even in the third quarter, I'm reading here.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. If we can maintain that kind of performance.
Jeff Madrick, yes, please.
I agree with a lot of Greg said, but I disagree with some of it. The productivity performance, productivity is a residual calculation. I think sometimes when people read about productivity, they get the sense that the government goes around and surveys businesses and asks them, well, how productive are you? How much output can you get per employee, per hour of work? Mm-hmm. And it's really simply the GDP divided by the number of hours worked, the amount of it's a simple arithmetic calculation.
But wouldn't you still rather have a growing productivity as a hedge against deflation?
The increase in productivity is usually very rapid if you're just bouncing off a bottom, number one.
Uh-huh.
Number two, I think companies these days are very aggressive about letting people go, about reducing hours worked.
Which makes the division work in its favor.
So I think it's much too early to seriously judge whether this is a reflection of more productivity. Remember, you know, the great Greenspan analysis is that the productivity came out of serious capital investment.
Mm-hmm.
So what you've got to argue is all that capital investment in the past is now being used productively.
To drive productivity.
It wasn't being used productively 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, the analyses they did showed that there was a kind of coterminous, a simultaneous capital investment and productivity increase. And that relationship, as we go along, is starting to look awfully iffy. Measuring productivity is very ambiguous.
So you're not fully heartened there. I want to get some more calls in. There's somebody who want to join us. Miriam's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Miriam. You're on
Hello.
The air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to look at this from another perspective.
Mm-hmm.
If there's overcapacity, and if there's overcapacity in the technology that was necessary for the information revolution,
all that optic fiber,
right? Exactly. There is a new frontier. I mean, in the American Prospect several months ago, there was a wonderful article on the possibility of a huge new economy that can be developed by developing the technology in many, many different areas. And I'm not talking only about,
for example,
solar panels and sources of energy.
Fuel cells and all the rest.
They went way beyond fuel cells,
mm-hmm.
although they, you know, I seem to recall that. I read this months ago, but it left a tremendous impression on me, and I think you even discussed it in a couple of programs, or somebody
mm-hmm.
did on NPR.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm thinking is that if there is overcapacity, I mean, this may be the wrong administration for me to make this proposal instead of lowering taxes on businesses where there is already overcapacity, why can't we take that same money and encourage the development of the technology for the technology for new energy
alternate energy sources. Let us pick it up, Miriam. Thanks for that. I want to put it straight to Greg. Yep. Greg, do we have blinkers on here? Are we ignoring a driver that we could hook up to all this capacity and capital and engine the economy forward?
Well, Tom, the sad truth is that to bring those innovations out, you need risk-taking. And we had a lot of risk-taking in the late 90s. We had NASDAQ 5000. We had billions of dollars going into telecommunications companies. And you can see the result of all that. A lot of people lost a lot of money. There is very little appetite for risk-taking right now. And that goes for things like these important and innovative projects that the caller was talking about.
So even if they would be good, even if it would be good for everybody if they happened, we may not be in a cultural moment where we're going to step up and grab that?
Sure. I mean, if you're a businessman, you're thinking about, in this kind of environment, what are the odds that if I put money into this kind of investment, I'm actually going to get paid well for it? I mean, if prices all around me are declining, then what are the odds that I'm actually going to be able to raise prices on this new product? I think I'd rather just sort of stay close to home.
It may be a while before we get back to the psychology of people being prepared to step up and grab those, but I can't wait until we do. Dick's calling from...
It might make sense longer term, though, once we get past this problem.
If we could get past the psychology, it might make sense now. Miriam, thanks for your call. Dick's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dick. You're on the air.
thank you. Your guest's opinion, please. Are we setting ourselves up for a fall because of the mortgage refinance boom in a deflationary period? Aren't we going to have to pay back a dollar for every dollar that we borrowed as opposed to the last boom? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, Dick, thanks for your call. Jeff Madrick?
Again, remember, deflation is not in the bag by any means.
Fully acknowledged, top to bottom.
On the other hand, we borrow way more than we ever did against our houses. The number eludes me a little bit at the moment. It's something like, I can't quite remember, but it's quite stunning how much we borrow against our homes these days. So a lot of the 1990s boom was created by borrowing. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had a low-wage environment for 22 years before 1996. Only then did wages really start rising strongly on a consistent basis for all levels of workers. So
we've seen the consumer debt, Greg Ipprights, has doubled since the 50s to 90% of personal income. But what about the mortgage refinancing in particular? That should, for many people, that will lower monthly payments, but others may be borrowing more to get some hot cash in their pocket.
I think the caller raises a great concern of ours, which is that essentially we've been trying to pull the economy out of recession by encouraging people basically to spend more. And how do they spend more? By borrowing. And how do they borrow? By taking equity out of their homes. Well, it's going to be a great plan if the economy does recover and we create more jobs and people will have plenty of income to pay back these debts that they've taken on. It's not going to be so great if the economy doesn't recover and we're stuck with higher unemployment and people who've built up all these debts to improve their houses or go on vacations and so on. I think it's a very delicate situation.
Gene's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Gene. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a question on does anybody ever win in a deflationary period? And, for example, we're maybe not the normal couple here, but we don't have any home mortgage. We do own our own home. It's maybe worth like $275,000.
Lucky you.
We don't have any debts on any cars. We just pay off everything early on from when we were first married. We pay off all of our home mortgages as soon as we had them, but that was in a time when interest rates were mortgage rates were probably 17%.
So you don't have a mortgage, you don't have consumer debt or credit card debt, and you're wondering how deflation would sit for you. Greg Ipp, how about it? Here, Gene is sitting on cash, not on debt.
That's a pretty good situation to be in if we actually had a deflationary environment. Essentially, if you're in a deflationary environment, you want to be in a situation where you can take advantage of falling prices without having those falling prices hurt you.
Now, how does cash help you do that exactly?
Well, cash, for example, doesn't lose its value when prices are going down.
It's becoming more valuable, really.
It increases the value, yeah, sure.
Exactly.
That happened, Tom,
mm-hmm. in the Great Depression. People who had decent jobs and were lucky enough not to lose them had a pretty good time when prices were falling.
Well, and we saw what the super wealthy did during the Depression, the kind of beautiful college campuses built when people were willing to work for almost nothing, and they still had a pile of cash, and up went whole universities. Well, it could happen again, I suppose. Gene, it sounds like you're in a fairly bomb-proof position for deflation, but it might not be fun if it comes anyway, if all your neighbors are not feeling quite so well off. Jeff Madrick, handicap it or give us what should we look for? What would be the signs that we're headed the right direction, the wrong direction in terms of the deflation risk?
Well, I think the signs are the strength of the economy. If unemployment stays where it is, keeps rising, if we're not able to create new jobs, we're going to be in trouble. The next big question mark, there are two. In general, will the consumer keep spending? It looks like the consumer is spending less now, and that he or she has been the prop for this economy, obviously not capital investment. And number two, will housing prices start tumbling? Because it seems as if housing prices are what's supporting what consumer spending we've been getting. If housing prices start going, we could be in a serious situation. I'm not that optimistic that the cut in the federal funds rate, the cut in the Fed rate will... even a 0.5% will set us back on the right track. I think we've entered another period. And without some fiscal stimulus, I think we could get in trouble.
And there's not much more room to cut. We'll be looking to see if that stimulus comes about. Jeff Madrick, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Jeff Madrick is a New York Times columnist and author of Why Economies Grow. And Greg Ipp, old friend, thanks for being with us to you as well.
All right.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Special thanks tonight to Robert Fraser from the studios of Monitor Radio in Washington, D.C. for helping us, as he so often does. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're